It's been interesting sitting in my office this past week and watching an interesting parade of folks come into our parking lot. Some of them are driving, some of them on their bikes, some on skateboards, some are walking. And they're walking into our church parking lot, realizing we have become a Pokestop in the Pokemon Go game. And folks are looking for their Pokeballs and eggs. And perhaps you've noticed such folks as well throughout our community. They're kind of easy to spot. They kind of look like this. And they usually have their phone in front of them. I've seen them walking down Ford Road. I've seen them in Target. And of course, I've seen them here in our church parking lot. There have been some reports that some unintended negative consequences are arising because of the phenomenon of Pokemon Go. Now it has become a global sensation, and I've heard that there have been, for example, curators at the National Holocaust Museum and folks at Arlington National Cemetery saying these are not appropriate places to be playing Pokemon. I've heard of other distracted drivers who have crashed into trees. Folks are trying to lure unsuspecting Pokemon players into unsafe places to rob them of their phone or other valuables. But for the most part, it seems to me that if people are using common sense, being aware that it might be a fun way to discover what's going on in our world. But my perspective is not shared by everyone, of course. There's a man named Rick Wiles who is the host of a broadcast called True News, who wrote these words. He says, "The enemy Satan is targeting churches with virtual digital cyber demons. I believe this thing is a magnet for demonic powers. What if this technology is transferred to Islamic jihadists and Islamic jihadists have an app that shows them where Christians are located geographically? Oh my God, this is a terrifying thing, right? That Pokemon is going to help Christians to be spotted hiding in churches in this holy war we find ourselves in." I agree with Rick Wiles that we are now in the midst of a spiritual battle. My sense would be that the battleground really isn't a virtual world, but the real world is probably the more appropriate setting for the battle we find ourselves in. And my guess would be that the demons aren't ones that we need to worry about, are the ones that are created by computer-generated imagery, but the mindsets, the attitudes, the spirits that seem to be swirling about in our world. The demons have names, like fear, anger, and violence. And I think there is a huge consequence that is being lived out about how we as people of faith choose to deal with these real powers, principalities, things that threaten the well-being of our entire planet. You know, folks can choose whether or not they want to engage in Pokemon Go, but you really can't choose whether or not you are going to be affected by the real battle going on in our world. You are being affected by the fear, and by the violence, by the animosity and hatred that seems to be in ascendancy right now in our world. And so I am far less concerned with how folks do as players with Pokemon Go than I am about how people of faith are dealing with the real struggles that we face in our world now. How do we become people who are effective in dealing with the real issues, the real struggles, the real opposition that's happening right now to God's kingdom? So this morning I want us to hear some wise words from a man who knew a lot about the reality of spiritual warfare, a man who had a keen understanding of how people of faith could be effective as advocates for God's kingdom. This man's name is Paul, and I want us now to hear these words from his second letter to the Corinthians. "Though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. And we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. May God bless to our hearing and to our living this reading from God's holy word. So we gather here this morning in the aftermath again of yet another terrorist attack. This truck armed with weapons and a man who was determined to kill as many people as possible killed scores of people in Nice, France on their national holiday known as Bastille Day. Well, people are still trying to figure out if he had an actual official connection to ISIS. ISIS itself has claimed this person as one of their soldiers. This morning, leaders around the world are trying to figure out again, how do we respond to a reality that's happening where folks are determined to cause as much damage, as much fear, as much death as possible in the world. And the Apostle Paul wrote this letter to the church in Corinth. He also was facing a threat against the well-being of a congregation that he had lovingly nurtured and begun. A few years after Paul had left the city of Corinth, some other folks began to infiltrate that church. They came under the guise of being mature Christians, but when they got into the church, they began to teach doctrine and began to operate in ways to try to undermine Paul's authority. Their goal was to sow seeds of distrust, of suspicion against their founding apostle. And they began to teach things about the Christian faith that Paul knew were not of God or not of orthodoxy. And so Paul wrote a series of letters. Scholars think there might have been as many as four letters that Paul eventually wrote, but we have a collection of two of them. And one of those letters that we heard this morning, Paul is trying to reassert the fact that as a founding apostle, that his goal is to make sure the church stays in a place of being God-centered and of God-focused. He's doing battle, you see, in his mind with ideas, with approaches that are threatening the well-being of that family of God. And in that letter he writes, the weapons that we fight with are not the weapons of the world. So here Paul might be thinking about gossip, dissension, creating slander, division. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds, to tear down those things that rise up that would cause God's people to be led astray. We demolish arguments and every pretension, every illusion, every false persona that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. See, Paul saw in those teachers a false perspective, a lust for power, perhaps. A desire to help tear down this budding movement that was formed around grace and inclusion. People were using the Christian name in an ungodly way. And so Paul makes it clear here that in his mind, his enemies aren't the actual people in the congregation who are doing this. His enemy, Paul realizes, are those greater powers that are trying to use people to be mouthpieces for division or slander. Conflict. So Paul understands that he's in a battle, but it's not against people who have flesh and blood. The battle is being fought in a higher realm, and so he returns to that same idea in his letter to the Ephesians, where he says, our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world. People themselves aren't the problem, Paul says. It's the distorted thinking that infiltrates the human mind. It's demonic notions that get into the human heart and give rise to things like racism and poverty and warfare. Our minds become susceptible to demonic ideas like all people aren't to be included in the family of God. Or some people are dispensable or expendable or are worth killing in the goal of pursuit of some other higher goal that we have. So battling these presumptions, these pretensions, these mindsets requires a different strategy than battling people. A young Pakistani woman Malala Yousafzai, who was attacked by the Taliban, put this truth so succinctly and beautifully, which she said, with guns, you can kill terrorists. With education, you can kill terrorism. We find ourselves now in a world where we can't kill ourselves out of the problems that we face. Guns and drones and bombs won't make us any safer. Because the real problem is not coming merely from flesh and blood. It's coming from notions, ideologies, idolatries that are swirling through our world. And that requires a different approach. It's always been that way. 2,000 years ago, Jesus also faced a world that was under the oppression of a Roman government that was ruthless in maintaining its power, had no tolerance for dissent, certainly did not grant civil liberties the way that we know about them. And so over and over, Christ is approached by people saying, how do we gain our freedom? How do we throw off the yoke of oppression? And over again, he was encouraged, take up the sword, mount an insurrection, let's get a movement going and kill these damn Romans. And over again, he'd say, no, that is not going to really defeat the true enemy. In fact, that will just lead us into an ever-deepening spiral of killing, retaliation, and vengeance. They took a different approach. It's a very simple one, but one that is profoundly difficult. Again, when he said, love one another as I have loved you. He had this crazy idea that somehow love would be the only weapon powerful enough to really drive back the forces of darkness. That only love that was bold in its approach, uncompromising in its intensity, undistinguishing who the recipients would be, that a love that would be ruthless, that would always seek the well-being of the other, no matter who that other might be, would be the only way that we as human beings would find ourselves out of darkness, entering into the light. And throughout his ministry, he was constantly reminding us of that reality. He would say, you know, you need to love your enemies too. You just love your friends. I mean, you're behaving just like unbelievers. I want you to be children of God who loves all people. But what he was speaking of wasn't just sort of a willy-nilly, mamby-pamby kind of emotion. He was talking about an intense, wise strategy to defeat darkness. He was talking about a love that would be clever, imaginative, resourceful. A love that would also collude with surprise and humor to help to expose darkness, to help to create possibility of transformation. See, this kind of love has as its goal securing dignity and justice for all people, and even including those who we might label as being representatives of darkness. So in our scripture reading where we heard this morning from the Gospel of Matthew, which is indeed, without a doubt, the most misunderstood verse in the Bible. For the last 500 years, it's been translated this way, I tell you, do not resist an evil person. Which if we read the Gospels, we know that that statement is categorically in conflict with everything that Jesus was about. He resisted evil at every turn. The notion that he would stand up one day and say, you know, if there's evil in front of you being done, don't resist it. Just let it have its way. We know it's complete nonsense that Christ never lived by that ethic. He would never counsel passivity in the face of injustice, evil, or oppression. The Greek scholar Walter Wink, who was professor of New Testament studies at the Auburn Theological Seminary, has done an in-depth study of the Greek verb actually being used in this passage. The Greek verb is antihistemi, And Wink knows that a proper translation of Jesus' teaching would be, do not strike back at evil in kind. Do not give blow for blow. Do not retaliate against violence with violence. He goes on to say that Jesus was no less committed to opposing evil than the anti-Roman resistance fighters. The only difference was over the means to be used, how one should fight evil. And interestingly, this mistranslation happened during the time of King James. And you might ask, why would the king want it to be put into the Holy Scriptures that people should not retaliate against things they consider to be evil? Might there be some political expediency for the king to want his people to believe that really you have no God-given right to respond in the face of evil? And Wink goes on to say that in the past 500 years since the King James Version, scholars have been rather lazy in not correcting that mistranslation. Christ never said, do not resist an evil person. Do not resist an evil person by using evil means. He never counseled passivity. He never counseled violence either. Why? Because using violence, you've allowed yourself to use a destructive impulse, and evil itself triumphs. So we humans tend to think there's only two ways of responding to things that are threatening. Either we fight or we flee. The fight or flight mentality. Wink notes that Christ here is laying out a third option, a third possibility. He calls it Jesus' third way. He knows Jesus abhors both passivity and violence as responses to evil. His is a third alternative, not even touched by these options. Now, I've taught about these three options at least two or three times in my ministry, and it seems like every so often we come back to a time in our culture's realities where we have to, again, remember, what is he talking about here? What does imaginative, creative love look like that uses humor and surprise to always expose and to resist evil without using violence? So I want to demonstrate, again, what these examples look like. I'm going to randomly pick somebody to... Julia, come on up, would you? Would you be my... So, again, you stand right up here. If he says, you know, if somebody strikes you on the right cheek, and you know that in Roman culture and the Jewish law as well, that the left hand was always considered to be unclean, the Qumran texts that were discovered said if you even gestured your left hand, you could be fined 10 monetary units. So left hand was never to be used in any sort of social interaction. So if I'm going to strike Julia on the right cheek, I'm going to be using my right hand. And hit her on the right cheek with my right hand is going to require not that I use my fist, because that's not going to work. It's going to require that I backhand her. Now, who gets backhanded in Jesus' culture? Again, there are laws that were very specific about this. If I punched a peer with my closed fist, I could be fined what was called four units. The units were called zuds. But if I backhanded a peer instead of using my fist, the fine went from 4 monetary units to 400. Now think about that. There was a 100 times greater penalty for backhanding a peer than punching them. Why? Because backhanding was considered to be such an insult. It was a way of saying to somebody, you are less valuable than I am. It was a way, right, of putting people in their place. It wasn't to cause physical violence. It was to dismiss them, to degrade them. So peers wouldn't backhand each other, but I would, if I was a man, I could backhand a woman, a child, a slave, a servant. So backhanding was a way that you kept the social order in place by letting somebody beneath you in culture's eyes know that they were being reprimanded. So he's talking very specifically to people who are what? On the receiving end of a backhanded slap. And he says, if somebody backhands you, Here's what you do. You turn your cheek the other way. So if Julia turns, if I backhand her, she turns her cheek, now what am I going to do? All of a sudden, my goal of just reprimanding her, putting her in her place, becomes interrupted by the idea, now I've got a decision to make. Julia is saying to me, you will no longer treat me like that. If you're going to hit me again, now you're going to treat me as a peer. She was causing the oppressor to notice her at the simple turn of the head to reassert her own dignity and to say that you will not anymore treat me that way. See, Julia had no option. If she were to strike at me and hit me, she would use violence as a response to what I did. As a person at the higher social order, what would happen to her? She'd be arrested, you'd have her flogged. By simply turning her head in a nonviolent way, she's saying to this person, notice me. Treat me with respect. The second one, we're not going to act out because it ends up with the person being naked, and I didn't think anybody would be kind of ready for that this morning. The Christ says, you know, if somebody hauls you into court and demands your outer garment, which, by the way, in Jewish law, Leviticus was allowed, there's actually a passage that says, if somebody owes you money, you are allowed to collect their coat during the day, but you must return it to them at night because it's all they have to sleep in. So he says, if you've gotten to a point of being in such debt to somebody that all you have left are the clothes literally on your back, and they haul you into court and they say, I want your coat today, I'll bring it back tonight, but just know that I will have your coat throughout the day. Christ says, if you get hauled into court and somebody asks for your coat, here's what you do. You strip down and take off all your inner garments well and you hand it to them. So you'll be standing there basically in a court of law, stark naked. Now why would Jesus encourage somebody to go into a court of law and take off their underwear and hand it to the judge saying, there, now you've got everything. He's really encouraging someone to use humor and clowning and surprise and shock to make quite a scene in that courtroom of justice. He's saying by simply doing that, you are exposing not just yourself, you are exposing the entire process of being brutal, uncaring. You are unmasking the facade of a dignified proceeding. You are showing forth the great inhumanity of what is happening. And imagine the buzz on Twitter and Facebook when folks hear what you did in that courthouse. And people begin to laugh and share. And all of a sudden, people begin to think, you know what? There are ways to respond to these powers that allow them not merely to degrade us, but to respond with humor and allow this whole thing to be kind of flipped. You begin to have a conversation about what's happened. Again, surprise, humor, exaggeration. To expose what? To expose the injustice of a system that was running rampant in Roman times. People were being forced more and more off their lands into poverty by an economic system that was putting more and more hands in fewer people. Does that sound familiar? In the third example, he says, you know, if somebody forces you to walk 1 mile, he's talking here about the fact that, again, there was a law in Roman times that a Roman soldier was legally free to tell any civilian, you carry my military hardware for 1 mile. You know, it gets tough carrying a 50-pound backpack all the time, so as a soldier, you might find somebody and say, hey, you carry this for the next mile. And Roman law allowed that. Now, you can imagine if you were out doing your normal routines, errands, if somebody all of a sudden puts a military backpack on you, you're probably not going to be very happy about that. And you're probably going to carry that backpack for the next mile grumbling, complaining, perhaps swearing. Letting that soldier know what you think about him. And usually at the end of that mile, you take off that backpack, you say, here, take it. And he says something different. You get to the end of that mile, here's what you do. You don't take out the backpack and say, hey, Do you want me to carry it for you a second one? Now, it's important again to know that Roman law prohibited a soldier from allowing that offer to be accepted. They now could be punished if they found out that a civilian had carried their military gear for a second mile. So now all of a sudden you're putting the soldier in a place where they had gone from issuing an order to having to think about something here. Now what was this person up to? What's their shtick here? What are they trying to do to me? Again, you've gone from being a faceless, nameless victim to somebody now who is requiring the oppressor to stop, to think, to notice. And you're also letting them know through your own response that you are refusing to buy into the victimhood mentality of anger and frustration and resentment. You've kept your own heart in a place of strength, and you are requiring the oppressor now to be put back on his heels trying to figure out what to do. In each of these cases, right, Christ is talking to people who are on the receiving end of mistreatment. And he's saying there's a way to respond, if you think about it, that turns the tables, that gets conversation going, that exposes an unjust mindset, to be far more effective than grumbling or punching or hitting back. The goal is not to defeat the soldier, or the debtor, or the person who's backhanded you. The goal is to defeat the mindsets that lead people to think that they have a right to mistreat other people. Your goal is to act in a way that creates space for the creditor and for the backhander and for the soldier also to wake up and to realize that they also have been brainwashed by mindsets that dehumanize both them and you. That's the greater goal. It's redemption. It's reconciliation. It's not merely vengeance or getting even or expressing your frustration. That just simply creates an unending spiral down into human degradation, conflict, and misery. You got to be clear about who the enemy is, says Christ. It's the mindset. It's the attitude. It's the perspective that sets itself up against God, who says all people have value and dignity and all people are to be treated justly and equally. That's the problem. So keep your eye focused on what needs to be done. See, Jesus' way avoids a horrific consequence that so often transpires when we try to battle evil. Again, Walter Wink put it so directly and frighteningly, and he says, we become what we hate. Now think about it. We become what we hate. The very act of hating something draws it to us. Since our hate is usually a direct response to an evil done to us, our hate almost invariably causes us to respond in the terms already laid down by the enemy. Unaware of what is happening, we turn into the very thing we oppose. We decry the use of torture by terrorists, but then we end up sanctioning enhanced interrogation. We justify, but really we allow ourselves to respond in the same terms already laid down by the enemy. So often you'll see children alcoholics become alcoholics. We so often, in our desire to get even, allow ourselves to adopt means that have already been shown to us by the opposer as being unjust, but we do it over and over again. And when that happens, darkness spreads. It's not evil that's defeated. And maybe that person gets neutralized. Maybe that life gets taken. But the motive, the desire, the energy behind that grows, gets stronger. The demonic powers apply. And all we can think to do is to keep doubling down on techniques that simply allow the darkness to get ever more dark. Christ gives us such a wise way The idea that love itself has to be the motive. And our goal is to be creative enough, imaginative enough, committed enough to use love in ways that expose the real enemy. That approach is summarized well by the Czech philosopher Milan Makovec, who wrote, "The enemy must be resisted insofar as he serves the power of darkness." Although it would be better to say that the power of darkness should be resisted rather than the enemy. He should be seen not as the servant of darkness, but as someone who is capable of a future conversion. Therefore, though he uses evil means, despotism, the sword, force, darkness, one must not answer him with these same means. If one answered him in kind with lies, deceit, violence, and force, one would be denying oneself and him the future and the possibility of change. One would be perpetuating the kingdom of evil. I've got to tell you, as your pastor, I worry about all of us. I think about all of you often. And my great concern in times like this is that we allow our own hearts and minds to become infiltrated with the attitudes and mindsets of our culture. We too begin to think that more violence is the answer. We allow ourselves to be filled with anger and hatred, animosity and conflict. We allow our hearts and minds to become contaminated by a world's perspective that's leading us into darker places. And so I feel that part of our challenge as God's people is to make sure that we are committed to the ways of Christ. That we stand guard against those subtle ways that we get seduced into thinking the way the world does. That we become mere cheerleaders of what governments are thinking to do, forgetting that we are here as ambassadors of God's kingdom. And that means we're not free to let go of the idea that we are called to love as Christ has loved us ever. And my prayer for us would be that God would give us holy imagination, steadfast courage, determination to love the way that Christ has loved us. Remember who the enemy really is. That we will never, ever kill our way out of this darkness. Only love. Only love can lead us forward. And it is the one who came, who showed us that, who lived that, who died that, who was raised by God to affirm that approach. It's in his name and by his power we give all praise and honor and glory. Today, tomorrow, and forevermore.